Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 229 for February 14th. Sun-kissed cars at the Amelia Concours. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Well, here we are, Gary Vasilash.
John, how are you?
I'm doing well. Good seeing you.
Good seeing you.
And we've got to give a shout out to John Manoogian, who's joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Former GM designer. Cadillac, right?
Buick, Cadillac, Pontiac, Chevrolet, Oldsmobile. Covered all the bases. Saturn.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And now an instructor at...
College for Creative Studies, adjunct professor.
Teaching new designers to come
in. The next generation of designers, yes.
That's cool. So, Gary, you weren't here last week. What have you been up to?
Well, I just got back from driving the 2015 Kia K900 luxury sedan, which is...
A Kia luxury sedan is almost an
oxymoron.
Yeah. It's a Kia luxury sedan. It's a $60,000 car, actually $59,500 with the V8 in premium package. It's a rear-drive car, 420 horsepower.
This is the same as the Hyundai Equus, right?
And
with a totally different body.
Separated at birth.
Right.
The wheelbase is the same, 119.9 inches, but the Kia version's a couple of inches shorter. Okay, and so the design, I would say, is sportier.
Unique sheet metal.
It's all unique sheet metal. Suspension is different because the Equus uses an adaptive air system, and the Kia doesn't have it.
This is a cheap car. Then.
And, one might make the argument that one is more plush and one is more driver-oriented. One might make that argument. I don't know that one would win that argument, but they could make that argument. It's got more LEDs outside and in. I mean, Audi would be jealous. It's got so damn many LEDs everywhere.
Yeah, right.
So it's a very interesting car, but, you know, it gets to the point of, you know, is Kia, you know, can you say Kia and luxury car? Okay. And, you know, cause that might really seem oxymoronic. And, you know, and I was thinking, well, you know, if you think about it, you go to a Chevrolet dealer and buy a Spark, right? And a Spark starts under 13 grand. Then you go buy a Corvette.
70,000.
Okay. So we somehow don't have a problem with that, right? We can just sort of think that, yeah, the bandwidth is there. So then I was looking, so the least expensive Kia you can get starts at 13.9.
What's that, the Rio?
Yes. So the Rio, 13.9. And then... It's $59,500 for
the top
the K900,
line.
Right? So now the starting price, though, for Corvette is $51,000. So you can go in and buy a $51,000 Corvette, or you can buy a $12,170 Spark. But again, you know, the whole question becomes, you know, what is the bandwidth that a brand can bear? And it's interesting that one of the rationalizations that Kia is making is the fact that the luxury brands are coming down, therefore they ought to go up. Okay, so meaning, you know, the CLA or the A3, things like that, which, you know, you get a lower price point. And because a Kia Cadenza is $35,000, so I mean it's above those cars already. So, you know, it's interesting whether, you know, they're going to be able to make any traction in that space. And the other question is whether they really need to.
Well, but if they get the product right, to me, that's always the bottom line. Once they get the product right, I think they can force that issue.
Yeah, I don't think they can. You know, and I only say that because the Hyundai Equus, what do they sell? 400 a month in the U.S. market. I mean, it's nothing.
Right.
It probably costs them more to just bring the car into the country than it's worth from that standpoint. I think this is pure ego on the part of Hyundai back in Korea and Kia back in Korea, deciding that, hey, we sell these cars in the Korean market, we should be able to take these cars and sell them anywhere in the world. I just don't see this K900 selling
much. So what if they had a separate channel? They call it, you know, black label channel or whatever, and they put those cars in it. Okay, so would that work?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what Hyundai wanted to do. That's what Hyundai in Korea wanted to do. They wanted to start their own Lexus, Infiniti, right, Acura, whatever luxury brand. And the Americans here told them, you guys are crazy. We haven't even established the Hyundai brand, really. We've really got to get that. We've got all this dealer work to do. And they finally pushed back enough that Korea insisted on the Equus coming over, but agreed not to do a separate luxury brand. I got to believe, whether it's 10 or 15 or 20 years, that's the ultimate goal for both, sure, of these brands, sure, to create their own luxury brand.
Genesis as part of Hyundai and whatever Kia decides to do.
So, yeah, that's...
Did they talk sales? They didn't put out any...
No, because they're basically saying that if we give a number and we don't sell to that number, then we're a failure. Mm-hmm. And if, sure, we give a number and we exceed the number, then it shows that we don't know what we're talking about, that we were wrong, right? I mean, that would be a, yeah, good problem to have, ideally. Yes. But I mean, it's just a sort of an interesting phenomenon that you see that happening in the industry, whereby, you know, you are having this shift of things. And they're also making the point that... since the Great Recession, that people are buying things differently than they were once buying things. And therefore, looking at it from the point of view of a value play, what are you getting for your money? And I think in the case of Kia or Hyundai, whether we're talking the Equus, we're talking the K900, or even talking the Genesis sedan, I mean, you know, you get a whole lot of stuff.
I was going to say, comparably to the Germans, you're probably getting...
A lot of stuff. Right.
And the other thing that's interesting that Hyundai has done with the Equus is they've treated the whole sales experience totally different than other Hyundais. So you can have a salesperson come to your house or your office or wherever you want to meet them. You don't have to go to the dealership. If there's any scheduled maintenance or problem with the car, they come and get it.
Yeah, how cool is
that? And leave you something,
sure,
else. Yeah. And if you have other Hyundais in your family, they'll give you the same treatment,
wow,
if you buy an Equus. And again, they're able to pull this off because the sales volume is so low.
Sure.
You know, a few hundred cars a month is all they've,
right,
got to worry about. But they're learning from this. You know, they're banking this knowledge, I believe, for a future point where they do come out with a separate brand.
See, but I wonder, I mean, would that even work, though? So you know, you have a car that you're retailing for $60,000, okay? And you've been doing this for a number of years. And then suddenly you say, well, you know, that $60,000 car, we're really not going to call it a Hyundai anymore. We're going to call it something else. We're not going to call it a Kia anymore. We're going to call it something else. Well, haven't you already spent all these years trying to make people believe
in the mind of the customer, yeah,
that,
sure,
that's what it is?
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, that's why you have a Chevy and you have a Cadillac, you know, you have a Toyota and you have a Lexus, you have a Ford, you have a Lincoln. I mean, and it's that you keep them in the family, because, you know, the argument is that, well, after they buy a Cadenza, where do they go? You know, there's no place, right, for them to go. And therefore, we always need something above that.
The old GM philosophy: start them in Chevrolet,
right,
and move them up to Cadillac.
Right,
uh-huh.
But in that case, though, they would have a sufficient number of brands, so you could sort of have a car per decade, and then you're,
right,
in the ground. So you know, it sort of worked out. So you wouldn't have to worry about going beyond Cadillac.
Yes, yeah.
Because you'd go to the, you know, in a Cadillac hearse, probably. I mean, it's
now, isn't the K900 called the K9 in Korea?
Yes, and then it's called the Chorus in other markets, but not spelled like Chorus as we would spell it. It's spelled the Q.
Q. Yeah.
And so I suspect there was a certain sensitivity.
I'm sure the American said you could not call
it. I don't want a dog.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't,
right,
want a,
yeah,
dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
I'm not gonna keep having a dog.
But I mean, it's an interesting thing. I mean, I
personally think that they'll pull it off. Maybe not to the levels of the Germans, but I think Kia and Hyundai are so driven.
Right.
They're going to make it work.
Well, you know, and Peter Schreier is no lackey when it comes to design. Obviously,
he's the man.
He has transformed the look of that company.
He's the man. That whole Kia brand in the last 5 years has just totally transformed itself, which is cool. I mean, it's great looking. To me, they're better looking than the Hyundai stuff.
I agree. Right. That's right.
But you know, it's like looks take you so far. Right. I mean, yes. And it's, you know, as that song that I'm sure that we remember, first I look at the purse.
Get him in.
That,
yeah.
I mean, it's just like, yeah. So good looking, you know, my wife won't like that metaphor. But again, I mean, because, you know, and you know, to that end, I was, you know, the J.D. Power vehicle dependability study came out, and I was looking at how these guys were doing. So industry average is 133 problems per 100 vehicles, and Kia's below average at 151 problems per 100 vehicles, and Hyundai's down at 169 problems per 100 vehicles.
Now, they used to be much higher up the list.
And you know, this is 3 years. This is the dependability study.
Sure.
So you know, to the point of, you know, that I'm thinking, you know, the issue of good-looking sheet metal. I mean, I would think
that only takes you so far,
right? And you know, to use another example, I mean, I think that, you know, like Dodge has just got gorgeous cars out there and have for a number of years, and unfortunately for Dodge, they're second from last.
Wow,
second from last.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Sergio's got his work cut out for him because every single Chrysler Group brand is significantly below average.
Wow.
I mean, it's Chrysler's at 155, Ram's at 165, Jeep's at 178, and Dodge is at 181.
Wow.
And meanwhile, Lexus, 68.
Hmm.
And coming in second is Mercedes at 104, okay? So I was looking at that, and so that's a 36-point delta.
Spread, yeah.
Okay, between where Lexus is and where Mercedes is. And so I thought, let's take these 36 points and add it to second place and see where it gets you. It brings you to 140, okay? Industry average is 133. So that space represents going below average and just happens to be the number where Ford is. So Ford comes in below average as well.
Hmm. Where's Toyota?
GM does great, by the way. Every single one of GM's divisions is above or at average.
Was it Cadillac, Buick, Chevrolet?
Cadillac.
Or GMC was?
Cadillac, Buick. So Cadillac is 107. They're in third place. Buick is at 112, comes in fifth place. Chevy is at 132, so that's below the top 10. GMC is at 133, and then average is 133.
I'm surprised GMC was actually below Chevrolet, but...
See, that's where I get a little bit puzzled about this because, you know, the GMC model line is matched vehicle by vehicle with Chevrolet.
Premium.
And where's Toyota on the list? Because...
This is an interesting one, too. So there are three companies tied at 114. Honda, Lincoln, Toyota. So the thing that strikes me as interesting about that is that, okay, if we look at what Lincoln is trying to do in positioning itself back in the market as a luxury brand, what do they compare themselves to? Lexus, right? You see those ads where they have the MKZ sitting
right
next to an ES.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, so they're making these comparisons. Oh, it's got this, it's got this, it's got, okay. And yet, in terms of the quality, now this is, you know, the dependability study, so this is, you know, looking at past, not present, but in terms of dependability study, they're actually with the brands that Ford is positioning itself against in its ads, right? I mean, so it's, you know, don't buy a Camry, buy a Fusion sort of thing. We have better quality and blah, 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 yet there they are below average. And, but, you know, to be fair, what's interesting is that J.D. Power found that it's engine and transmission problems that were causing much of the dismay that people had, and they found
that's a shocker to me.
Well, and this
engine
is
engine and transmissions. It's like,
well, they're saying that the thing is that, you know, as the OEMs are trying to do more with four cylinder engines,
sure,
that this is causing a certain number of problems, and you know, I think that was if you looked at some of the Consumer Reports stuff about Ford's problems, and everybody said, oh, it's my Ford Touch, that's the real reason it's a problem. EcoBoost engines were causing a significant number of problems for those guys as well. So it just wasn't the you know, dodgy electronics. It was that engine. So, you know, I think with time that'll change. But they found that this is the first time since 1998 that problems have gotten greater,
man,
not gotten less.
Well, you know,
less.
I'm not sure I totally buy what J.D. Power is saying. They constantly change their survey. It makes it very difficult to go back and compare quality ratings to prior years because they're changing it. And part of the reason, I think, is because today's quality is way better than it was, say, 20 years ago. And so they still want to be able to say, oh, here's a brand with a whole lot of problems to it. I have a hard time believing that Toyota would have nearly twice as many defects as Lexus. I find that hard to believe.
That doesn't surprise me at all because if you look at the way the build for Lexus products versus the build for Toyota products, I mean, that these Takuri that they have that are working and, you know, these master craftsmen that are putting together Lexuses, I mean, I think that they're hardcore on that. And I think that they realize that, you know, for them to be a highly credible premium brand and to be highly competitive with the Germans, right, that they have to go above and beyond. And so they have that build quality that's built in. But, I mean... But if you think about it, though, okay, so take Lexus out of the picture as just being, you know, the unrealistic outlier, okay? But then you have basically, I mean, there's 10 points between Toyota and Mercedes. So it's within spitting distance. And I think that they actually build them better. So.
Well, they may build them better, but remember, the Lexuses are... by and large, far more complicated cars, much more equipment on them, many more lines of code. And that's why I'm just skeptical of the J.D. Power numbers. I'd love to see the questions that they're asking, too, because design issues became defects in a lot of these surveys that J.D. Power does, too. So, I mean, is this literally somebody saying, boy, I don't like this small EcoBoost engine? It's not delivering the kind of fuel economy it should, and therefore it's defective.
It's probably drivability, not so much.
I don't know.
I think there's a lot of things, but I mean, to the point of whether design is a defect or not, and somebody's not going to like me after I make this comment. But okay, so they look at segments and they rank vehicles within segments, and the large car segment winner is a Buick LaCern. I'm sorry. I mean, you can't say that. That doesn't have a design defect.
I worked on that one.
So you're going to jump.
We're going to let that one go.
Yeah, you're going to jump across here and grab me, but
it's all right.
So it beats the Toyota Avalon. Now this is the last generation Toyota Avalon because it's 3 years old, and Ford Taurus. Now I think the Ford Taurus is a pretty good looking car.
Yes, it is.
And
it
you know,
is.
And so the it would be the current one that's out there. And I mean, I think that if you look at that car, and you can actually see in some ways where the current Fusion came from.
Oh yes, yeah.
You know what I mean. So that was actually starting this whole thing. But I thought the J.D. Power thing was interesting. And
you also thought it was pretty interesting that Richard Petty was dissing Danica Patrick.
Yeah, that was pretty phenomenal. According to Wheels.ca, Canadian website, at the Canadian Motorsports Expo. The King, Richard Petty, said that Danica could win a race only if, and I quote, everybody else stayed home. And he went on to say, now this is a quote from them, if she'd been a male, nobody would ever know that she showed up at a racetrack. This is a female deal that's driving her. There's nothing wrong with that because that's good PR for me. More fans come out, people are more interested in it. She's helped draw attention to the sport, which helps everybody in the sport. So, I mean,
he said that. That to me is just a big mistake.
I agree, John. He didn't have to say it. It is pretty obvious. You know, it's look, you know, Danica won one race in Indy, and that was a fuel economy run. And look, she's talented.
She's drawing people to the sport.
Oh, I know. But so exactly, and that's why you don't have to come
out. Why would you badmouth that? I mean,
yeah.
I would suspect there's got to be a lot of male drivers who are saying to themselves,
well,
what, you know what, I finish...
Of course.
Six.
And nobody cares.
Pays attention
to me.
Yeah, she gets the interview.
And
yeah,
she's always the one who's the microphones are all on her. Yeah.
Right.
That's
and
part of the entertainment part of it.
Too.
Yeah. And so the question becomes, you know, how much of this is real racing versus how much of this is shtick? I mean, isn't that what it comes down to?
Yeah.
And, but yeah, the king, Richard Petty.
Who's going to talk about the vote at the UAW in Chattanooga for VW?
This is really getting hot.
It is. That's going to be a huge deal because I know from my own experience what that means. And it's going to be interesting to see if VW behind the scenes kind of twists some arms and, you know, make some statements. But I'm interested to see how close the vote is going to be between what the workers on the line do versus what VW management wants. Then you got Senator
Bob Corker,
coming out and saying, "We're going to give them a new vehicle if they don't vote in the UAW." And it's like, "Whoa, you know, how can he say that?"
Yeah, no, he came out and said that he's been told, or he implied that he had been told
yes.
that if the workers reject the UAW,
right.
Volkswagen will put an SUV in the plant.
Yep,
and then the plant manager came out. Frank Fisher, I think, is his name. And he came out and said, no, nothing to do with the vote. This is not going to affect. And then Corker came out today with a statement that
yes.
said, listen, this decision's not being made by the plant manager as to where we put this next SUV.
Right.
That's being made in Germany. Remember, Corker was then mayor of Chattanooga when Volkswagen announced it was going to build the plant there. He's got deep ties into Germany. And he's saying, I wouldn't have come out and said this unless I knew what I was saying was absolutely accurate.
But to me, it was a huge mistake for him to sort of come out and just talk about that because, you know, when that vote takes place, it's all, you know, secret and you don't know who's going to vote for what. And for him to sort of be churning that whole cauldron.
Well, John, thank God we don't live in Chattanooga because they're being bombarded with TV, radio, ads, billboards. I mean, so Corker's just part of the whole mix of things.
Sure.
I don't think he's standing out any more than anyone else except for the fact that he's a senator and saying...
But that's going to be a big deal because if they go to the UAW, then you have all these other manufacturers in Alabama and everywhere else that are going to say, well, is that going to affect us?
Sure they will. And so, and it'll be especially BMW and Mercedes,
right?
Being other German companies
right.
that also have works councils and labor representation on their board of governors,
yep.
going, well, we're going to be next, and none of the transplants want this.
Oh man, I know.
The interesting thing is, the Detroit 3, GM, Ford, and Chrysler would actually like to see the UAW win this vote.
Of course.
They want to see these guys, the transplants, with the same union headaches they've
Absolutely.
Got to put up with.
Absolutely.
So they're actually quietly rooting for the UAW to win this thing.
Right.
So I guess we'll know maybe this weekend, maybe Monday, you know,
what the outcome is. The vote is going to take place soon.
No, it's taking place right now.
Oh, right now.
It started
now,
yesterday.
Okay.
It's going on today. It concludes tomorrow. They get 3 days to vote.
Then they
And then I guess it's the NLRB, right? The National Labor Relations Board that's going to count the votes. That's what I got. They're not going to trust the company
it's
or the union to count them, right?
Yeah. Entity, yeah.
One for me.
Yeah.
The hanging chads.
Yeah, that's right.
None for you.
Yeah. But you're right. This is a big deal.
It's a big deal.
If the UAW wins, it's a massive victory. If they lose,
it's going to be a big deal too.
It's going to be a crushing blow.
Yeah,
crushing.
Let's say they lose. Okay, I mean, how is this a crushing blow? They still have the members that they have,
and
the relationships that they have created. I think in this town, post. Bankruptcy post recession. I think that they've gotten themselves in a situation where they understand that there needs to be, you know, everybody, you know, behind the arrow, pointing it in the proper direction.
And the problem is they don't have enough members right now.
Right.
Their membership's going down. But again, I mean, I don't see them. I mean, if they win, it's upside. If they lose, it's status quo. Right. They don't. They're not going to. So
I view it more as a huge defeat if they can't get this VW vote.
Because they've tried at Nissan, right?
Yes.
And
I mean, more than one occasion.
Different plants.
Right. I mean, and
they never got anywhere. Did
it hurt them?
Well, I think it does. I think the long-term future of the UAW is grave. It's not good.
Right.
They're not earning enough money to keep themselves. They will not be able to self-fund the union. That's where they're at. They need several hundred thousand more members to be able to say, yeah, we can look deep into the century and we're still here.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. It'll be status quo in the sense that it's not that they're going to collapse next week if they lose this vote.
Short-term,
they're going to be around.
Stay the same.
Short-term, you're right.
But in the long term, I mean, if they do something to reinvent themselves, or they do something to become more proactive, more education, say, for their members, get their members to do different things, I mean, they can be a very positive force for that, and
sure.
It could be highly beneficial. So, you know, I just don't see it, you know, necessarily going south for them immediately as a result of this.
No, it will not be immediate.
And, you know, and then again, as you point out, I mean, in Germany, I mean, that there is representation by the labor unions on the board.
Right.
And there's a person who's responsible for that, and he's a, you know, a member of, I don't know, IG Metall or something.
That's right. And, by law in Germany,
half
of what they call the supervisory board has to be comprised of labor members.
Right. And then when you look at, you know, coverage of what goes on in plants there, I mean, it seems to work out just fine, and they keep putting product into places like Ingolstadt and so on. So,
yeah,
you guys.
I think it'll be a blow to the labor movement because it's so visible. You know, it's like the big game, and you lose it.
But if Corker hadn't come out and started making these comments, I think it would just be under the radar, and I don't see the advantage for him necessarily to do what he's done. But what do I know? I'm not a politician.
Hey, why don't we take a quick break, and then we'll get Bill Warner in here, and we'll talk all about Amelia Island, the Concours there. So, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our good friends at Firestone.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. Legendary durability. Impressive mileage. Firestone tires. So unstrap the saddle. These old stallions are ready to run. Again. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
AutoLine offers you one of the most effective ways to get your marketing message in front of the decision makers in the global automotive industry. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
Before we get going again here, Ben Sanders in the control room just did an Insta poll of the viewers who are watching live right now with the question, would you pay $60,000 for a Kia? 29% said yes. 71% said no.
So 29% said yes.
29% said yes. Hey, actually,
this
for Kia, that's a big number.
Yes, it would be. It certainly would be.
Even though most people don't want it. But anyway, Bill Warner, welcome to AutoLine After Hours.
Well, it's nice to be here. I'll be back at 70 degrees tomorrow, though.
Yeah. Hey, it's balmy here.
It's cold today.
29.
They call it breezy.
Breezy. Bill, whatever got you into this Concours business? You've done everything. You've been a photographer. You've been a writer. You've been a racer. I don't know what all else you've done. What got you into this?
I think it started at birth. I was always a car guy. And when other kids were playing baseball, I wasn't very talented at baseball or football. I'd pedal my bike to the car dealerships and drive them crazy and collect literature. And then when I wanted to go to the art center in Pasadena and be a designer, and we couldn't afford it. So I went to a military college, the Citadel, and got a degree in engineering, which I never used, and went in the family filter business. But all along the time, I was doing work for Sports Car Graphic and then Road and Track Magazine. Magazines being historically cheap, it was easier for them to send me from Jacksonville to Daytona and Sebring than to fly someone from Los Angeles. So I got close to racing. Back when I was in high school, I drove a parts truck and service truck for a Volkswagen dealer who had a race team, and I got bitten by the smell of castor bean oil and the noise. So all this has been going along. The contacts I made through Road and Track Magazine with the people in the industry allowed me, when the Ritz-Carlton came to me in 95 and said, we want to do a Concours d'Elegance. Well, I didn't know anything about a Concours d'Elegance. You know, I don't really pick grass out of the tires. You know, I'm not that kind of guy. I like to drive my cars. But at the time, my father was in hospice, and I said, well, if we can do something good for the community and raise some money, let's do it.
Sure.
And Mercedes-Benz came on as the founding sponsor, along with the Ritz-Carlton at Amelia Island. And I often said that I had confidence we could do this, and confidence is the feeling you have when you don't truly understand the situation. And it was Jacksonville is really a great car town. You know, we're close to Daytona. We're about 1.2 million, so we're the largest city in the country. No one knows where it's at.
I had no idea.
I didn't either.
It's over 1 million people.
Yeah, in the metropolitan area, sure that. You know, and so we had a good audience to draw from, and we were equidistant from Miami and Birmingham and Atlanta and Charlotte. So we thought regionally. We never thought globally. Now the Geneva Auto Show affects us in some cases on cars that are rolling out there or new reveals at Amelia, and we're going to have a reveal at Amelia I can't talk about until the Wednesday after the Tuesday reveal in Geneva, you know.
Wow.
We were just worried about not being on the same weekend as the Bausch & Lomb tennis tournament or the Players Golf Championship. So it just kind of went together. I spent 30 years in the Florida Air National Guard and in the Air Force, and a lot of the people I draw on have a military background, and this is like a mobilization exercise every year when we do the Amelia Island Concours.
Your Concours, you were talking about your background with racing and covering racing and so on, and it seems that your Concours has more of a racing flavor to it than, say, a Pebble Beach, that there's a greater emphasis on that.
You know, the biggest influence on what we did was through Dave Holes and Don Sommer at Meadowbrook. Peter Brock and I had known each other for years when he was running the BRE racing program at Dotson. And I called him. He was the first guy I called. I said, well, I'm going to do a Concours in 3 months. How do we do it? He says, you got to call this guy, Dave Holes. I called him on a Sunday afternoon, and he spent 3 hours with me on the phone.
Wow.
Yeah, Dave was one of my mentors.
Well, he was a great guy.
GM designer.
Guy. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, Oldsmobile mainly, right?
Well,
he did everything, too.
He did the Buick Riviera, the 66 Riviera.
Dave was a great guy.
He did the second-generation Camaro.
Yep.
And the Seville.
Yep.
And he was I probably one of the biggest car enthusiasts I'd ever met.
He was.
He called me kiddo all the time. You know, well, kiddo, this is how you do this. So I called Don Sommer, and they helped me out. And when I looked at it, you know, Pebble Beach is the gold standard. It's been around 63 years. I like racing. And I also feel that there's a component in Concours that everybody misses. And the secret is right out there. It's people. The cars glue the people together. So our first honoree was Sir Stirling Moss, and that gave us some credibility. And I said, well, why don't we take our racing heroes and build a show around them? And then we had Phil Hill, who I had known through Road and Track, and then Carol Shelby, and then Hurley Haywood, and Brian Redmond, Jim Hall, and Bobby Unser, who's a story in and of himself. And so I just picked guys I always wanted to have a weekend with. And we do seminars every year, and we'll do a seminar on design. You know, we'll have Ed Welburn's been down, Freeman Thomas. They bring down concept cars, and we bring in at-risk and sometimes regular high school students. We'll bring 500 of them in, and we'll get someone from we need to get you down there. We get Stuart Reed from Art Center, and we tell these kids there's more than flipping hamburgers.
Right.
You can be a car designer. You can be an engineer.
Exactly.
We have that's part of our outreach program in the community. So it kind of grew. The first year when we had Stirling Moss there, I said, we'll get a couple of his cars. And I said, no, why don't we do a whole thing we got two fairways. We'll do one fairway will be sports and racing cars, and the other will be the classics. And then about 10 years in, we're sitting there saying, you know, who's to say a Ferrari GTO is more important or less important than a Duesenberg SSJ? So I said, why don't we have to do two best in shows? Well, you know, Concours de Sport, Concours d'Elegance. And Christian Philipson from Monaco, who's the representative for Louis Vuitton, says, you are making a mistake. You can only have one best in show. I said, no, we got two fairways. Right. I said, let's do two best in shows. So every year we line one up on one end of the field and the other, and we bring the winners up nose to nose. And like you say, you had a Ferrari GTO and a Duesenberg Marmon Meteor one year. You'll have the Le Mans winning Ford GT40 with another Duesenberg SJ. So we wanted to redefine ourselves. We didn't want to copy other shows. And you can go to Daytona, and the chances of you going down and shaking the hand of Jeff Gordon or Tony Stewart's probably pretty slim. But you can come to Amelia, and on the island will be Bobby Unser this year, Al Unser, Parnelli Jones, Johnny Rutherford, Hurley Haywood, Brian Redman. We're honoring Jochen Mast in the 25th anniversary of his victory at Le Mans in the Mercedes Sauber. And, you know, blatantly we do heritage marketing for our sponsors.
What do you mean, heritage marketing?
So many manufacturers, and the three best at heritage marketing are Mercedes, Porsche, and BMW. They understand their heritage, and they want to tell the story of how where they got where they are today. And we help them with that. For example, with Mercedes this year, we're talking about the technology that allowed them to win Le Mans, you know, 25 years ago. With BMW, it's going to be the Batmobiles from the 70s, or Brian Redman David Hobbs, who BMW came in the racing, the technology and how they took that technology and morphed it into better production cars. So heritage marketing from us is from a racing standpoint, but still, like with General Motors last year, we had 15, I think, Cadillac concept cars. The Le Mans. Do you remember the Le Mans?
Oh, yes.
There were four built. One burned in a garage fire, belonged to Harry Carl, who was married to Debbie Reynolds. General Motors sold their concept cars to influential people until the attorneys got in and said, you can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, the attorneys have been the worst thing for great cars that
collectors,
are around there.
Yeah.
Yeah, for collectors. So there are three left. General Motors has one. They redesigned with dual headlights and tail fins. And there's a gentleman in Maryland has one of the others, and it had not been seen in years. And we had the two Le Mans prototypes there. Now, for all of you out there who want cars, there's a third one missing, if you can find it. And it was black and last seen at the Oklahoma State Fair in 1956. You'll have to go back, but it's out there. So it for me, the challenge is to have cars on that field that well-educated car fanatics like I am come on the field and say, I never knew that car existed.
So it's part of this is not only the opportunity to see great cars, great sculptural design of vehicles, but actually to learn
tell the story
history and to learn about how racing drivers did what they did, and by holding these seminars that you were talking about. And,
yeah. This year, the two seminars are great offie drivers. It's going to be Johnny Rutherford, Parnelli Jones, Al Unser, Sr., and Bobby Unser, and David Hobbs. And Hobbs says, well, I wasn't a great offie driver, so we're calling it the Great Offie Drivers with David and David Hobbs.
Yeah.
And Hobbs has a great sense of humor. And we're going to have Louis Meyer, whose dad was the Meyer Drake, and developed the Offenhauser engines. And then Saturday morning, we have what we call the Merchants of Speed, playing on Michael Kaiser's book, The Speed Merchants. He gave us permission to do that. And we're going to have John Meekum, who used to own the New Orleans Saints and was the cover guy for General Motors back in those days when General Motors wasn't racing. Meekum's team was running the Grand Sport Corvettes. He's going to talk about how he was the front man for General Motors and later went on and won Indy. We're going to have Ray Evernham, and I want him to discuss how when you have multi-car teams and three drivers or two drivers with a common goal, how do you manage that? How do you confirm to the drivers that each driver is getting a fair shake in the deal? We're going to have Bobby Rahal, and he's going to talk about how do you handle having your son as your driver?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be great.
That should be interesting.
Yeah, what happens when he breaks the equipment? Is His allowance.
I gave you a car, son. Look what you did to it. You hit the wall. We're going to have Alwin Springer from Porsche. And, you know, he started with Wojciech Polak and came up and was running the Porsche engine program for him. And Bob Tullius, who I have two of his old race cars, so this is kind of self-serving, but Bob's going to talk about how he started out racing a Triumph TR3 and went to Le Mans and Indianapolis and NASCAR with Group 44. We had a sad occasion this week. We were going to have Tyler Alexander from McLaren. He started with Bruce McLaren and just retired last year from McLaren. And tragically, he had a stroke last Friday, so he's not going to be able to make it. But the group we've got put together, we get 1,000 people for the seminars. The best one we had was we had two good ones. We had I ran the Cannonball in '75, so we brought back Brock Yates and Bill Broderick and Oscar Kowaleski and Judy Stropas and all of us who ran the Cannonball and told the Cannonball stories. People like that. The best one I enjoyed was, and this is one of those nightmares that you have. I had the three greats. It was going to be Richard Petty from stock car racing, Sir Sterling Moss from sports car racing, and Don Garlitz from drag racing. Yeah. That was the seminar. We had all the posters done, had everything up. The Sunday before the Saturday seminar, Susie Moss calls, says, "I got bad news." I said, "What's that?" I said, Sterling fell down the elevator shaft and broke both ankles.
God.
He can't come. That's terrible. I said, "How's he doing?" He said, "All right, didn't hit his head, but he's going to be out for a while." I hung up the phone. My wife says, "Who is that?" I said, "Susie Moss." I said, "Sterling fell down the elevator shaft, and he's supposed to be here next Saturday." She says, "What are you going to do?" I said, "There's just so few greats out there." I picked up the phone and called Carol Shelby. I said, "Carol, here's the deal. I'm in trouble. Can you help me?" He says, "When do you need me?" I said, "I need you next Saturday." He said, "I'll call you back in an hour." Call back, says, "I'll be there." Mm-hmm. So we had Carol Shelby, Richard Petty, and Don Garlitz. And Garlitz was phenomenal. I got to tell you, he's one of the most polished guys you ever want to be around. You think of drag racers being, you know, the rolled up sleeve with a cigarette pack. And he had the line of the day. He says, "I've learned three things about drag racing." He says, "Gasoline's for washing parts, alcohol's for drinking, and nitromethane's for racing."
Well spoken.
And the audience just exploded.
Sure.
But that's what we like to do. We like to get people engaged in what's going on with their heroes.
So it's not just walking around eating canapés and...
No.
That's Pebble Beach.
Careful.
Okay, how do you pick the cars? I mean...
I pick what I like.
Good.
You know... we do have a rule, no Pacers and Gremlins. You know, that's the first rule. But a good pint of Guinness will get me going. And we did a class 1 year. We like to do an entertaining class because we know that husbands bring wives out there, and wives say, "I don't go to any car show," and they get out there. So we did great advertising cars. We had the Moxie Rolls Royce with the big white horse where the guy drives the horse on the field. We had the Zippo Lighter Chrysler, you know, with a big flame coming out the top. And we topped it off with the Allegheny Ludlum stainless steel Ford and the Veggie Mobile built by George Barris that looked like a can of V8 vegetable juice. We don't want to take it too soon. No, that goes back with the Gremlins and the Pacers.
No Wiener Mobile?
And then we had the greatest racing livery on any car, the Red Lobster March, you know, with the big claws. Wasn't that
big
terrific?
Claws on the fender.
Yeah,
yes.
Dave Cowart and Kemper Miller's car.
Yeah.
And this year we're going to do beach cars because we're on the beach. We got, you know, Fiat Jollies. I tried to get Volkswagen to send over there. They've got one Jolly. And they wouldn't do it. So they get left out, Volkswagen. You missed the boat. But we've got...
Wasn't the thing a beach car originally?
No. Well, kind of. We've got Bruce Meyer. He's going to be selling celebrating his, I think, 84th birthday, and he's bringing the first Myers Manx. Mm. But we've got all the little beach cars, the Fiat Jolly, the Eden Rock, and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's the entertainment side of it. And then we have the serious collectors with the Duesenbergs. And what's really important is picking the right cars to go into a class because they're all going to be judged against each other.
Right.
And if you throw pre-war European in with post-war European, it's not fair to either one. Mm-hmm. And we got a great Ferrari lineup this year of race Ferraris from everything from the very first Ferrari race in the United States that Miles Collier has, the 166, right on up to a P4, which is one of the most beautiful race cars.
Of all time.
Of all time.
Of all time.
Do you ever worry about, geez, somewhere down the road, we're going to run out?
No.
We're
going
to have shown it all.
No, we got so many ideas down the road. I can't talk about them. Well. But we got some fun stuff coming in the next couple of years. Sterling Moss is going to be back for 2015 for our 20th anniversary. Okay. This year we're doing the 100th anniversary of Maserati, and we've got, I think, something like 14 race Maseratis, starting with the A6 GCS up to the Birdcage. And then we've got street Maseratis. In fact, we've got one Maserati called the V4. It was 2 8-cylinder engines side by side. Where they got V4 from? It's a U16. And then we've got Dan Davis from Jacksonville has just finished the restoration of Samson. It's a 1933 Miller Indy car that has, from the trash formula, it's got twin Miller 8-cylinder engines on a common drive shaft, just like the Maserati. Neat thing about it, and this would be a great trivia question. The Samson, which ran in Indy in 1933, was the very first race car to have two-way radio communication between the car and the pits.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
33.
Yeah. It has an antenna that starts at the front and goes all the way the length of the car.
Wow.
It had a little tube radio, and the riding mechanic, you know, would have a helmet on with a microphone built in. It's really cool.
Wow.
They didn't have to do the hand signals then, huh?
No, just call in. The worst thing about radios is they can call you. I've been on the receiving end of that. Why aren't you going any faster? I'm going as fast as I can.
Let me ask both of you guys, okay, since you're so much into car design. Is there a particular period and a particular brand that is just has not been excelled since a certain point in time?
Mm. What's your favorite car? One car. Somebody say one car.
I don't have one.
Okay.
I don't have a single favorite car. There's too many cars that I love.
Yeah.
Like the P4. That's one of my all-time favorites. The Stratos show car from that's one of my all-time favorites. So one of the things I wanted to ask you, though, was when you guys set up the judging, and I'm sure some of the viewers are interested in hearing how you do the judging, do you start with 100 points and subtract, or do you start with zero and then you build up a score?
Well, I'm going to blow the image of all this.
That's okay.
We don't do points.
You don't do points?
We don't do points.
I didn't know that.
Points can kill you. And I've seen it at a show, which will go nameless, where if you score points, like if you have a convertible, you got to show the convertible top moves and all that stuff. And a gentleman was showing a 1938 Horsch Special Cabriolet.
German, yeah.
And the class was pre-war, post-war European altogether. And a Mercedes-Benz 190 SL won the class. Now, the best 190 SL in the world should not beat a 1938 Horsch Special Cabriolet. The guy got but beat on points because he wasn't going to put his top down. It's eight layers. You'll never get it back up again. Yeah. And what if you have a fantastic car? Let's say you have an Alfa Romeo 8C 2900, probably the most beautiful post-war car ever built. I mean, it's breathtaking. Even people don't know car, their breath is taken away when they see it go by. So a taillight doesn't work or the horn doesn't blow. Are you going to knock that out of contention? I try to get a team of three judges per class.
And that's usually a good way to do it.
Yeah. One is the expert on the car. He knows every nut and bolt. He knows what's supposed to be. The other one may be a driver who raced that car or a designer that was associated with that car. And the third will be a general person who knows cars generally and knows design and can weigh in on the vote. But I really don't like points judging. And I've had a lot of people tell me, you're wrong. You should do points judging. And I'm not going down that road.
I've judged at La Jolla and Meadowbrook and a couple of places, Eyes on Design. Mm-hmm. Eyes on Design, no points, which you know.
And Meadowbrook, same way.
And Meadowbrook. And so...
Or no longer Meadowbrook.
Yeah. St. John's.
St. John's, yeah. But it's interesting because I agree with what you're proposing. And to me, that's why you're one of the top three in the country. You know, you got Pebble Beach, you got the one here, which used to be Meadowbrook, and then Amelia Island. Mm-hmm. Those are the three top concours, hands down. And so if you don't use points, then you use kind of judgment, right? It becomes a subjective.
Well, kind of.
But, you know, you're still being subjective in awarding points.
Well, yes, you know what? A lot of these people award points, then get down to the bottom, and you have a judgment call on design, provenance, everything else. So you've gone to the mechanics and doing all these points. You get down to the bottom as well. Okay, we'll just throw 20 points in to make this the winner. Right. So I say, what difference does it make? What I do is, like with Maseratis this year, we got Adolfo Orsi. His family owned Maserati. He's a Maserati historian. Yeah. You know, I send them the list of the cars so they can do their homework before they get to the show. And I don't have to worry about him. He knows what he's looking at. He's lived with those things. So when we have special classes like Maserati, I'll get the expert in there.
Has there ever been a really controversial decision?
Oh, yeah.
So give us an example.
I try to stay out of the choice of best in show. I leave it up to the judging team, and whether the judging team brings their results in, and I have the team for Concours d'Elegance, Concours de Sport. And one year, I'll just tell you, one of the cars I thought should have won didn't, and in retrospect, I should have stepped in and said, you guys are going down the wrong road on this, but I have to stay clear of it. We had one car that was re-coachworked. In fact, Meadowbrook had the same situation. They had a Packard Dual Cal Phaeton that was a recreation. It was fantastic. The car was perfect. You couldn't tell it from a real Packard Dual Cal Phaeton. But they chose it as best in show. Now the people with the real cars saying,
that's an issue.
That was a big issue.
Yep.
And we try to vet all our cars before they get there, because they're fake cars out there. Did you know that? They're absolutely bogus.
Go to an auction sometime, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, they're Packard Speedsters that were never Speedsters. They started as a sedan. There's Auburn Speedsters that started out as something else. There are Ferrari GTOs that are fake. Yeah. And
In the 18 years that you guys have been doing this, have there been a couple years where you really thought those cars were really memorable? I mean, I know they're all your kids, but were there a couple that really sort of come to mind that you remember that were really stellar?
The Hiso Zinnia that's now in the Mullen Museum, which had a compound windshield in 1935-36.
Yeah.
The car is just breathtaking. It had doors that pulled out and slid back.
It was fat in the car. Awesome.
It's awesome.
It looked like it came out of a sci-fi movie
from the 30s.
Yeah, real Buck Rogers.
Kind of
probably the Alfa Romeo 8C 2900, my personal favorite. You know?
Yeah, that's another one.
I like Ferrari Series 1 Cabriolets.
Yep.
I like Ferrari short wheelbase Berlinettas.
All the good ones.
I like an RS60 Porsche.
Okay.
Ford GT40.
That's good.
Yeah. Corvette Grand Sport.
You nailed them all.
You know, for me, the exciting part is dealing with the people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had the opportunity to meet all my heroes. And I've had a lot of fun. And, you know, when I started this, I was 51 years old. I'm 70 now. And the knees don't work as good and the legs don't go as fast, but the enthusiasm is still at the level it was.
That's awesome. Cool. That's really good.
It is.
Hey, we got a number of questions here coming in from the audience. Mm. Why don't we get to...
They dropped the charges.
Yeah.
You weren't there at the time.
No, I wasn't there.
Dr. Botox wants to know, will all six Bugatti Royales ever get together again like at Pebble in 1985? Maybe a 30th
probably not.
Reunion?
No. The cost of doing that is prohibitive, and you'd have to get the blessing of Volkswagen, which owns, I think, two of them now. We did the post-war version of it. We got all of the Grand Sport Corvettes together, and that was a big deal. And that's difficult to do. And the funny thing was we had John Meekham there that year who, you know, ran the Grand Sport program for Chevrolet. And all the Grand Sport owners are there, and they're shaking each other's hands and patting on the back. And John says, I don't know why they're all excited about five of them. There were six. You should have seen their faces drop. And it turns out there was a sixth one, but General Motors destroyed it. Yeah, they scrapped it.
Mitch W. asks, do you have an opinion on, and I hope I pronounce this right, the Simeone collection in Philadelphia?
One of the finest collections in the world. Dr. Simeone is has been passionate about cars since he was a child. His father was into it. He has the largest literature collection in the world. Yeah. I'll tell you a funny story. I'm at Hershey going down the aisle, and there was a car that was going to come out in the 50s that probably no one remembers. It was called the Argonaut. It was going to be a V12, and they were going to do a sports car and a sedan and a limousine, and the sports car was called the Argonaut Smoke, and it was this long thing. I'm going along, and there's a factory brochure on the Argonauts.
Wow.
I grab my cell phone. I call Fred. I got something at Hershey. It's about $1,000, but you got to have it. It's a factory brochure on the Argonauts. He says, "Oh yeah, I got two of those."
Amazing.
But what a collection! I mean, his tastes go to race cars, and it should be on everybody's bucket list to go to Fred's museum in Philadelphia.
Is it open to the public?
Oh, yes. Yeah. He's got a Grand Sport Corvette. He's got a Cobra Daytona Coupe. He's got an Alfa Romeo T3312. He's got a Porsche 917, the psychedelic car. He's got Ferrari Testarossa, Maserati 300Ss, Alfa Romeo 29s. He's got three or four of those. The Mille Miglia winning cars. I mean, a DuPont, a Le Mans DuPont. Mark IV Ford, unrestored from Le Mans. It's just fabulous.
Unbelievable.
Good question.
Yeah.
I hope he goes there.
Yeah. I've never heard of this. I just learned something.
Well, you know, the other museum he should go to is the Collier Museum in Naples, Florida. They've now opened it to the public, you know, Miles Collier's collection. Mm-hmm. It's probably the best all-around collection of automobiles in the United States, maybe the world.
Wow. Where would you put the Nethercutt collection?
Right up there. It's not as broad. You know, they're more towards the classics.
Exactly.
If you go down to Collier, you'll see a Duesenberg, a dual cowl Phaeton next to Miles Collier has a 57 Volkswagen with all aluminum sheet metal and a Porsche flat fan Carrera engine in it. You know, so you
wouldn't see that at the Nethercutt. Yeah.
No, you wouldn't see it at the Nethercutt, but the Nethercutt's museum. The car you ask about cars that have won at Amelia, the 20 grand won a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
You can see where Bill Mitchell got his influence for the doors on the Cadillac.
Coming up in the route. Yep.
Right,
yep.
From that Duesenberg 20 grand.
Yep.
Let's see here. Goggles Pisano says, which driver would you like to honor that you have not had a chance yet?
Well, I get in trouble on this, but I'll tell you, I've asked him three times. He turned me down three times as Mario Andretti.
Really?
And I had Parnelli Jones and Brian Redman both called him and said, you really want to do it? He said, I don't want to do it. I said, okay.
Wow.
I called him three times. His agent called me the third time and says, don't bother us anymore. So I said, okay, I won't.
Wow. Surprised.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I was too. we've got a list of guys that we want to have. And we like NASCAR. You know, we've had Bobby Allison, Richard Petty. I'd like to do Don Garlitz. I think we've probably favored the sports car side too much. But, you know, we had John Surtees, the only guy to win the world championship on two wheels and four wheels.
Yeah.
You got to hear these folks' stories before our time runs out.
Right.
We've got a phone call here. Ben, let's bring that one in.
Hi, John. Ray Schaefer calling from Jacksonville, Florida. Great show as always. My question is for Bill Warner. Bill, you do such a great job with the show every year, and you seem to outdo yourself, and the selection of cars is just incredible. Can you tell us how you and your team go about the selection process? Thanks. See you in March.
Right, Ray. I know, Ray. That wasn't a planned question. Thanks. I got back to two bottles of Guinness. We'll sit around and start.
Yeah.
Now, actually, we've got Chuck Dressing, who is on our staff. He's the voice of Le Mans. He lives three blocks from me in Jacksonville. He's a great writer. Used to be editor of the Vintage Motorsport magazine. And we'll sit down and say, what happened 50 years ago we should be celebrating? Or what happened 25 years ago? What happened 75 years ago? Next year, like, for example, it's the 60th anniversary of Volkswagen in America. It's the 50th anniversary of McLaren. We got 19 McLarens on the field this year. We've got to the two Indy winners, the Johnny Rutherford Golf High Gain McLaren. We've got the Mark Donohue McLaren that won Indy. We've got the Spanish Grand Prix winning McLaren MC23 of Jochen Mass's. We got two other Grand Prix Marlboro Max. We've got everything from a Mark I Can-Am car to the M20. With Denny Holmes' M20. We've got one of the Le Mans BMW McLaren F1 cars. We've got one of the only I think, two or three M6 coupes. You know, so the display of McLarens on the field is going to be a killer. The display of Maseratis is going to be a killer. Ray, I think it's Chuck Dressing has probably the biggest influence on how we do this. And we try to think 2 and 3 years out. We're already planning 2016. We know what we're going to do in 2015.
So it sounds a little bit like it goes back to when you were working on the magazines, that you'd pick a theme and then chase the information to fill the theme out. So you would say, okay, there'll be a 50th anniversary or 60th anniversary. Now let's see how we can fill in the story with sheet metal rather than fill it in with words.
That's right. I say that the two fairways in Amelia Island are my canvas, and every year I paint a story. Mm-hmm. And we're getting back to heritage marketing. We want to tell a story of how we got where we are today. I think manufacturers who don't understand their heritage are doomed for failure. If you don't know where you came from, you're not going to know where you're going.
Exactly.
And you don't know how to define your product to the customer you want to reach. We talked about Volkswagen and the Phaeton earlier, right? Mm-hmm. You're talking about Kia going up market, and Volkswagen tried to go up market here with the Phaeton, which was a fabulous car, and it failed because Volkswagen had done such a good job at defining who their market was that when they went out of it, they weren't successful at it here in the United States. I think that very few companies can successfully go both up market and down market.
Though several are trying that right now. We're seeing, you know, BMW, Mercedes, Audi going down the market.
Yeah. You know, it was kind of funny because I talked with a friend of mine who was a Mercedes dealership, had a Mercedes dealership. When they came out with that little C coupe, the sales were decent, but the people who bought those weren't used to what the costs were to service a Mercedes. So suddenly they get a deal on the car, but then they're being charged the same rate per hour as a guy with the S-Class sedan. And that was a problem there. Mercedes is one of the few companies that can go up market and down market successfully, with the exception of the Maybach, which I thought was...
Yeah, you know, that was a little too much.
Yeah.
But they didn't have the Mercedes badge on it. That was a different brand.
That's right. But Volkswagen had a fabulous car in the Phaeton, but people weren't... You know, guys going to go to the golf club, so I just bought a new car. I paid $125,000 for it. Really? Why'd you buy a Volkswagen? I mean, they could have called it a Wartburg and sold more of them.
Yeah, they could have. They could have. That's right. There's a car or a name with heritage.
Yeah. I don't know if we'll ever do Wartburg.
It sounds better in English if you pronounce it Wartburg.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey, Campbell wrote in, did you guys see the sinkhole that hit the Corvette,
Corvette Museum?
Oh, my
unbelievable.
God. That was...
it's like the earth opened up and...
Did you see the video of it happening in real time?
The
security camera.
And the cars at the bottom looked like scale models in the photograph. It's like...
not... That museum's got to be a total write-off now.
I heard portions of it still open.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
I tell you, the impact of that is...
building. I mean, the parts were still open.
They're going to have a challenge in future years, and I'm sure they'll address it on if people want to commit loans of cars to the museum if they're not convinced that it's structurally sound.
GM had two important cars there, yes.
Yeah, the Blue Devil?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Alexander Karabitsis has got a question, and I knew this one was coming. Of all the modern-day exotics, which do you think will be as special, timeless, and memorable as the cars that come to the concourse?
Well, you know, I'm asked that often, and I go back to, look what the kids today have pinned up on their wall, and that's what it's going to be 25 years from now. I think the Ford GT, for the reason is Ford didn't have a follow-on car. It was a one-shot deal. Any Lamborghini or Ferrari, although I favor Ferraris built prior to 72. You know. I got Chuck Jordan's old car. You know, the one the styling studio did the Superfly.
Hello, Daytona.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Fabulous design. Modern day cars, it would have to be limited number cars. Certainly the Bugatti Veyron, you know, but who can afford them?
Right.
It's interesting. I just got back from Retromobile, and the prices are absolutely astronomical on cars. I mean, a Ferrari Daytona, which would have sold for... they went up in 89 and they dropped off. You could have got I saw a Daytona sell for $250,000. And now they're at $600,000, $650,000. A Maserati Ghibli Spider, which was selling for $300,000, $1,000,001. You know, there's kind of the luster off the muscle car market. I think they're just an assemblage of parts, and that's why, you know, when you get into coachwork cars or cars limited to a production of less than 100 or 150, I think it's a good bet. There'll be good long-term investments. Mm-hmm. I'm at the age I can't wait for that, yeah. You know. If I didn't buy them 20 years ago, yeah. It's too late.
Let's see. This is not for you. Mario Paredes from New York City wrote in saying, going back to your question about the J.D. Power survey, he says, a friend of mine bought a Jeep Wrangler and gave it a bad rating because he could not find the door switches, which are in the center console, and the roof was leaked because he had not properly shut it. So is that the car's fault or the owner's fault for not reading the manual?
Yeah. You know, when I get those J.D. Power surveys, they don't ask the right questions oftentimes, and so I am suspicious oftentimes of some of those results.
But in the case of those two examples, though, would it not be a failure of ergonomic design?
Oh, absolutely, and that's a big deal these days.
Well, it depends, because the window switches are right in the middle of the console, but we're so used to reaching to the door armrest, yeah, door panel that you got to reorient and go. So it's not ergonomics. It's we're creatures of habit. We just go to the same spot every time same area.
Well, it looked like if you came out of, I don't know what a Cadillac is today, where the power seat controls are, but for years you reach down to the side of the seat and you got to move them up. If you drive a Mercedes, they're on the door, you know, the little outline of the seat. Mm-hmm. If you continue to drive Mercedes, then the ergonomics don't play into it because they maintain a continuity of it. But if you come out of one car into another, like a guy buys a Jeep and he came out of a Hyundai, he's got to educate himself. I was talking with a friend of mine who in a Mercedes dealership, and I said, how much time do you take with a customer now to explain all these things to him? Because I remember when BMW came out with the first, was it iDrive?
iDrive, yes.
They came out with a wonderful system that worked for a guy 20 years old, but the customer who was buying it couldn't understand how to make it work. Yeah. They have since adjusted for that. But he says sometimes 2 hours. With the customer.
I believe it. Yeah.
Yeah, there's so much in cars today. You know,
they're better than ever.
They are better than ever. And, you know, part of the thing, too, is most people are going to own a car for a number of years. And you will learn more about your car the longer you own it. So you don't have to learn everything all at once. You need to know the basics. But I think part of the fun of car ownership these days is you can continue to learn what your car can do for you.
But some of that stuff is frustrating, particularly when you're trying to get the radio or the HVAC to work. I don't want to have to think about that. I want to be able to turn a knob and have the heat come on or go off. I don't need to, like the Lincoln with the touchscreen in it, it drives me crazy trying to adjust that thing.
And they're, you know, putting more knobs and buttons back on the
set. So would that be a flaw if you owned the car and
I'm the car owner, I believe that's a flaw, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Everything has to be intuitive, I would think.
Right.
But you think so?
But then you come into the question, okay, it's a flaw from I don't like the way it operates, but the thing operates just fine. So is that a defect, really?
No, they're measuring problems. They're not measuring defects.
Problems.
So problems per 100 cars.
That could be misleading.
Yes.
But so your inability to be able to turn the volume
up. It's frustrating, yes.
That's a problem. Okay. To your point, it probably has a Six Sigma rating in terms of electronic capability, and it's all there. But yeah, you know
it
what?
It all works.
It all works if you can make it work.
You can't figure it out how to get it to work.
Well, then it's a problem for you because
you bought the
car, yeah, right? And it should work. So, you know, to the point of, you know, what was the genius of Apple? That we can all use these things and don't have a manual. Yeah, right?
Right.
You know, they don't sell these with manuals.
Exactly.
We figure out how to work them.
I bought an iPhone 5S at Christmas. I needed to upgrade. It's got this Siri, you know. Mm-hmm. Siri, dial John. And it comes back, mobile or home? And you tell it. This thing drives me crazy. She'll do it 3 times and she gets mad at me. And I got to turn it off and reboot it. I've had a GPS system to get so mad at me that when I didn't turn where it wanted to do, it just quit telling me where to turn at.
Hey, we ought to wrap this up. But before we do, Bill, you got to tell us, when is the Amelia Island Concours?
Starts March 7th 8th, and the big show is on the 9th. We have a free show to the public on Saturday where the clubs come in and bring their cars in and the public comes in free, and then Sunday is the show. We're a 501c3 charitable foundation. We've raised about $2.5 million for charities.
Excellent.
Spina Bifida, our granddaughter was born Spina Bifida. That's one of the charities. We're the largest single contributors to Community Hospice of Jacksonville, Spina Bifida of Jacksonville, the Navy Marine Corps Relief Society of Mayport, and the Shop with Cops program for underprivileged children in Nassau and Fernandina Beach. So we're there to do something good for the community, and we do have these outreach programs for students that we bring them in. So March 7th, 8th, and 9th, be there to help us celebrate the 25th anniversary of Mercedes' victory at Le Mans with Jochen Mass.
Cool. That's cool. That's really good. And John Manoogian, thanks for coming in tonight.
Thanks,
man,
for having me. This is always fun. It's always great.
And Gary, good seeing you. Yeah.
Oh, they can go to www.ameliaconcord.org, and there's videos there, and there's the whole schedule. Thank you, John.
That's great. You're more than welcome, and want to thank everybody for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at autoline.tv.